Professor Charles will make a plus for constitution law.
Is it already started recording? Okay, for those of you who are just picking up, one of your classmates has said that he will try and get you the first few minutes, but the recording device wasn't here, so I'm just going to keep going from where I was. When can states prefer their own and when can they not? We were talking about higher education, where they can prefer their own, versus roads, courts, fire, and police, where they cannot prefer their own. And the argument is roads, courts, fire, and police are limited resources. They are like the limestone in the Reeves case, whereas higher education is not a limited resource. You can get it from a lot of different sources, and so the state has no monopoly on that, whereas the state has, if not an actual monopoly, at least an effective monopoly on things like roads, courts, fire, and police. That's just a posited rationale for why states may prefer their own sometimes when they create a resource and not at other times. Okay, and that was all I was going to say about Dormant Commerce Clause and market participant exception. But let's turn to a different aspect of state protection, state regulation, and that's the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4. Now, Article 4, Section 2 says, the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. This, again, refers to the rights that you get by virtue of being a citizen of a state. The citizens of each state shall be entitled to whatever this clause gives them. And so the question is, what does this clause give them? What are these privileges and immunities of state citizenship that the state must respect and must protect? Well, historically, this clause has gone through at least three different iterations in terms of what it protects. So if you go back to the very earliest cases, Corfield versus Coryell, you see it on page 279 in your book. This is an 1823 case. In the beginning, not surprisingly, because this was a notion that was popular at the time, this clause protected natural rights. What were the privileges and immunities you had by virtue of being a citizen of a state? They were natural law rights. These were rights that you had not because they're part of positive law that we put into law, but because you were a human being. These were rights that citizens of free governments everywhere could expect to have. These were fundamental to being citizens of a free government. And these kinds of rights included, for example, you don't get this part of the decision in your text, but the court actually names a number of things. Give you examples. The right to travel. Citizens of free governments can travel from place to place. They can reside. They can pick up residence in a state. They have the right to habeas corpus, not to be imprisoned by the state without trial, without cause. They have the right to use the court systems. The right to engage in property transactions, buy and sell property. The right to equal taxation with citizens of the state they happen to be in. So, in other words, under the first iteration of Article 4, citizens of a state, when they went to another state in the United States, carried around with them this little bundle of rights, these natural law fundamental rights. And the foreign state, the state they went into, if you're from New York and you went to New Jersey, then New Jersey, the foreign state, would have to afford you these rights, would have to respect these rights, would have to allow you to reside there, to buy property there, to be equally taxed there with in-state citizens, etc. So I like to call this the suitcase theory. You walked around with your little suitcase of rights. You went from state to state with your little suitcase of rights. In this first iteration, then, the Privileges and Immunities Clause actually created rights. It embodied created rights, fundamental rights of state citizenship. In the second iteration, which came about roughly 50 years later, you see an example in the Paul case on page 276, Paul versus Virginia, where here the court says, well, you know, the purpose of the Privileges and Immunities Clause was to relieve the disability of alienage, whatever disability that is, by virtue of being an alien citizen, a citizen of a different state in a foreign state, and inhibit discriminatory legislation. So the purpose of the clause was to prevent states from acting in a discriminatory way towards out-of-staters. This is a familiar concept, right? This is what the Dormant Commerce Clause was understood to do. So similarly to the Dormant Commerce Clause now, that notion starts to creep in, where the court says, yeah, that's what it was intended to do. Make sure out-of-staters get fair treatment by a different state. So each state under this iteration was required to give out-of-state citizens the same fundamental rights, whatever they were, that the state gave to its own citizens. So there's a comparative component now. Therefore, if you are a foreign citizen, the foreign state that you're now in would have to give you whatever fundamental rights it gave its own citizens. That meant two things. It meant it did not have to give you non-fundamental rights that it gave its own citizens. So it could give its citizens unimportant rights, and you could be denied them. But any important right, it had to give you. It also meant that a state could withhold fundamental rights from you as a foreign citizen if it withheld them from its own citizens, even if they were fundamental. So if New Jersey decided not to give some fundamental right to its own citizens, it could likewise deny it to New Yorkers. In this iteration, then, the clause doesn't create rights. It doesn't embody rights of its own. It doesn't create rights itself. Rather, it looks to the state to create the rights and then requires the state to extend those fundamental rights to out-of-staters as well. Okay, that brings us to the third iteration, and that's the sort of more modern view, which we see in the Toomer case on page 279. This case embodies what we call the substantial reason test, or sometimes it's called the Toomer test. It's T-O-O-M-E-R, not T-U-M-O-R. Please don't put that on your exams. The Toomer test, it looks like a growth is happening. It's the Toomer, T-O-O-M-E-R. Okay, so this case says that a state may treat out-of-staters in a different way. It may discriminate against them. It may afford different treatment to in-staters and out-of-staters, but only where there is a valid reason for treating the out-of-staters differently that is independent of a desire just to discriminate against them. There has to be some other good reason, not just because they're from out-of-state, we don't care about them. But there has to be a good, valid reason for discriminating against them. And the nature of the discrimination has to bear a substantial relation, hence the substantial reason test. It has to bear a substantial relationship to the problem it's designed to address. So if the out-of-staters are presenting some differential kind of problem that the in-staters are not, the state is allowed to address that. But it has to address it in a way that truly remedies the problem, or else there's not a substantial reason for treating the out-of-staters differently. So it bars discrimination against an out-of-state citizen where there's no substantial reason for it, other than the fact that they're from out-of-state. Now, in this way, the Toomer case shifts the analysis from identifying what are fundamental rights, either by virtue of natural law or by virtue of state creation. So it shifts from deciding what are the fundamental rights protected, what are fundamental rights of state citizenship, to instead analyzing the state's justification for treating out-of-staters differently, for imposing a discriminatory burden on out-of-staters. In that case now, the analysis has moved all the way toward what the Dormant Commerce Clause does, essentially. It's very similar now. It looks for, is there discrimination and why? It's a different question than in the earlier iterations. Now the clause prevents unjustified discrimination. A completely different kind of analysis. Okay, so what about today? What does the court do today? Well, I go through all this history. In part it's interesting, but in part it's because today the court combines, actually, a little bit of each of these analyses in what it actually does to determine whether Article 4, Privileges and Immunities, is violated or not. The court engages in a two-step analysis. Step one, it says, is the right at issue fundamental? What's being complained about? What right or privilege is being infringed for an outsider, for an out-of-stater? Is that right or privilege a fundamental right? And the court here says that the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4 only protects those privileges and immunities that, and here's the modern notion, that bear on the vitality of our nation as a single entity. Only those rights that bear on the vitality of the nation as a single entity. Well, what privileges are basic to national unity then? That's what they're looking for. What kinds of privileges are basic to national unity? Are courts being open to all, is that basic to national unity? Open on an equal basis to in-state and out-of-state citizens? Yes, probably that is. Would we fall apart as a nation if people from out-of-state couldn't get the same treatment in a foreign state? Yeah, that's really a serious matter. So that kind of discrimination is unconstitutional, or at least it passes the first part of the test. There's a fundamental right at issue. Higher education, well, probably not, because it's okay if the state discriminates with regard to higher education. It's not that fundamental. You can get it from many sources. What about beaches? Every year when I say this, people think I'm saying something else, but I'm saying beaches, the beach, the Jones Beach, to be more precise. Is it important that Jones Beach be open to out-of-staters the same as New York-staters? Are we going to fall apart as a nation if our beaches are not open on an equal footing to all? Is that fundamental? Well, you know, I don't know how you feel about it, but I'm not a beach goer, so I kind of say, well, the beach, you know, how important is the beach? You could discriminate with regard to beach access, but in fact, you know, it's not fundamental. But in fact, discrimination with regard to things like beach access turns out to be often unconstitutional for reasons that we'll get to later. So not here, but for some other reason, it may be unconstitutional. Okay, so the first part of the modern test is the right at issue fundamental? And the second part goes to the tumor test. If it's fundamental, is there a substantial reason, an adequate justification, for discriminating against out-of-staters with regard to that right? And again, it has to be a reason independent of the fact that they're from out-of-state. They have to be, in other words of the court, a peculiar source of the evil. The out-of-staters have to be a peculiar source of the evil at which the state discriminatory policy is aimed. And there has to be a substantial relationship between the state's discrimination and the evil it's trying to remedy that comes from the out-of-staters. Okay, everybody got that so far? Okay. Now, one issue that arose, which the court sort of decided but not completely after this modern standard was set forth, is can you violate the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4 where a state facially treats in-staters and out-of-staters the same, but there's a discriminatory effect on out-of-staters? So we know that when a state facially, on the face of the measure, has a different treatment for in-staters and out-of-staters. You know, in-staters pay one tuition, out-of-staters pay a different tuition, right on the face of the policy. That's subject to privileges and immunities analysis, whether it's constitutional or not. But what if, on the face, it says everybody's charged the same, but for whatever reason, the burden's all falling on out-of-staters? We saw this often in the Dormant Commerce Clause arena. And remember there, that is subject to Dormant Commerce Clause analysis. If you have a burdensome effect on out-of-staters, even if the measure is facially neutral, that can violate the Dormant Commerce Clause. We saw many examples of that. So does the same thing apply to the Privileges and Immunities Clause? Can it be violated where there's a discriminatory effect? And that was an open question for a while, up until 2003, actually. And in a case you see on page 281, the Hillside Dairy case, the court held that a state can violate the Privileges and Immunities Clause without facial discrimination on the face of its policy or statute. But there was another holding that leaves us still a little bit in doubt as to what this means. The court did not decide whether a discriminatory effect alone is enough to violate the clause, or whether a neutral classification has to be proved to have had a discriminatory intent. Does it have to be proved that the neutral classification was just a proxy for the state's intended differential treatment of out-of-staters? So the state meant to kind of sock it to the out-of-staters, so to speak, but on the face of the measure, treated them the same. But it intentionally created that discriminatory effect. And we don't know whether, in the next case that comes along, it needs to be proved that the state intended to create that effect, or it's enough to show that there was that effect, and there could be a violation just because there was that effect. So that's an open question. Now, comparing that to the Dormant Commerce Clause, remember that when there's a discriminatory effect, essentially, under a protectionist purpose analysis, you're still going to have to ultimately prove that the discriminatory effect had a protectionist purpose, right? We don't usually see cases where there's a discriminatory effect and no protectionist purpose, and the court says Dormant Commerce Clause violation. Usually, the discriminatory effect alone will not be enough, and the court will require some showing of protectionism, even though that's not part of its balancing. But it does usually seem to require that. So maybe similarly here, the court would do the same thing. Okay, any questions so far? That privileges and immunity. Okay, now I started to compare them. Let me formally compare the Dormant Commerce Clause and the Privileges and Immunities Clause, because both of them, and this is a similarity, they both are used to invalidate state laws, state actions. They're both a means of invalidating a state regulation. They both have a common purpose: to promote national unity. Right? So they're very similar so far. And they're both aimed at discrimination against out-of-staters, or discrimination, well, I should say against, right? Against is a better word. Against out-of-staters, vis-a-vis in-staters. So this is what they have in common. But they're not exactly the same. They don't operate in exactly the same way. So let's look at the differences. These are the similarities. Let's look at the differences. There are at least three areas of difference between these two clauses. First, the subject matter covered. What is the subject matter of the Dormant Commerce Clause? Business that affects more than one state. Remember, any commerce affecting more than one state, affecting interstate commerce. What's the subject matter of the Privileges and Immunities Clause? The treatment of out-of-state citizens in a foreign state. And again, foreign means one of the other United States, not a foreign country. State literally means state, not country here. Let me illustrate that point by looking at one of the cases in the book, the Baldwin case. This is the recreational elk hunting case that you see on 277, named and in footnote A on that page. The state of Montana imposes a licensing fee for recreational elk hunting, and the fee is $225 for out-of-staters and $30 for state residents, a huge difference in treatment. The court concludes that this is constitutional under the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4. Why, by the way? Why is it constitutional? Yeah. Elk hunting isn't a fundamental right, exactly. So we go to the first part of the two-part analysis, and this fails the first part. Elk hunting's not a fundamental right. You don't even go to the tumor test, because it's recreational elk hunting. It's not for food or, you know, commercial use. It's recreational. So, you know, if you don't get it equally from out of state, big deal. You know, other states are not going to retaliate over such a measure. Could the plaintiff in this case could raise a privileges immunities case? He lost, but he could raise such an argument. Could the plaintiff have raised a dormant commerce clause argument? Could he have said the dormant commerce clause is violated by this differential licensing fee for recreational elk hunting? Yeah. Well, you'd have to show that there's some interstate business affected by the differential licensing fee. Well, what interstate business is affected? A person is affected, but it's hard to see where this concerns interstate commerce. The ability to recreationally hunt elk does not appear to concern interstate commerce. So the commerce clause, in order to make a commerce clause argument, subject matter wise, you have to identify the commerce connection. Now, I suppose you could make a commerce clause argument here, because if somebody's going to go recreational elk hunting in Montana from another state, they have to fly there or drive there. There's some interstate travel. When they get there, they have to stay in a hotel. They have to eat. Somebody said last night in my evening section, well, it's like the Heart of Atlanta Motel effect on interstate commerce. Ollie's Barbecue effect on interstate commerce. And that's true. So if the court's willing to engage in that broad understanding of interstate commerce, perhaps you could show that there's an effect on interstate commerce. How significant? I don't know. You might end up with an insignificant burden on interstate commerce. I don't know how much recreational elk hunting actually goes on. And how many people will be deterred by the significant, actually, difference in the fee? I don't know. I don't know anything about the character of Montana elk hunters and, whether $300 is insignificant to them or not. I really don't know. But notice that the subject matter is different. If you want to make the dormant commerce clause argument, you have to articulate that connection. If you're making a privileges and immunities argument, you don't have to articulate some connection or effect on interstate commerce. Okay, the second difference concerns the parties who are protected by the clause. The Privileges and Immunities Clause only guarantees rights to the citizens of each state when they're in another state. So who can raise this claim then? Who can say my rights here were violated? Citizens of each state when they're in another state. Who is that? All U.S. citizens? No, actually not. Citizens of a state when they're in another state. Yeah. Well, individuals, but which? Not every individual in the United States. So who can raise? No? Yes. Well, I think we're getting a little confusing. In which, I think we're just talking past each other. It's not that you're all wrong. Yes, Ms. Mills.
Just an out-of-state?
An out-of-stater. You can't raise this claim against your own state, is what I meant to say. You're right. Ultimately, any U.S. citizen could raise it if they're in another state and treated differently. So the only one who can raise it is an out-of-stater. You can't complain about what your own state is doing. You can only complain about what another state is doing to you. So you have to be an out-of-stater to raise a privileges and immunities claim. Whereas when it comes to the Dormant Commerce Clause, anyone who is appropriately affected by the discrimination, and we'll get to standing rules at the end of the term in the last week, and you'll know who that is, but anyone who is affected by the discrimination against interstate commerce so that they have standing can raise it. In other words, in-staters or out-of-staters could raise a Dormant Commerce Clause claim. You don't have to be an out-of-stater to raise it. Another difference in parties, individuals and companies and institutions can raise Dormant Commerce Clause claims. We've seen that. Many companies sued under the Dormant Commerce Clause. See a lot of company plaintiffs. But when it comes to the Privileges and Immunities Clause, if you go back to that old case, Paul versus Virginia on 276 again, the court says corporations are not citizens for purposes of the Privileges and Immunities Clause. So companies cannot raise privileges and immunities claims. Only citizens can, and that the court here takes to mean only people, actual human beings, can raise these claims. So limitations on who can raise privileges and immunities claims that don't exist for Dormant Commerce Clause claims. And the third difference has to do with the method by which each of these clauses goes about protecting out-of-staters as compared with in-staters and accomplishing the national unity that they're both intended to accomplish. They don't do it in the same way. The Dormant Commerce Clause does it by ensuring the free flow of goods from state to state, ensuring that free interstate transportation of goods. The Privileges and Immunities Clause does it by tying the fate of the out-of-stater to the fate of the insider, of the instator. And let me again use a case to illustrate the difference. If you remember back to the Dormant Commerce Clause case that we looked at, Hughes versus Oklahoma, this was the little minnows case. Remember those cute little minnows that Minnesota did not want exported, so it banned the export. And the court held that that violated the Dormant Commerce Clause because there was a discrimination against interstate commerce, against other states that might have wanted the minnows. Now, Justice Rehnquist, in his dissent, says, well, there was no Dormant Commerce Clause violation here, is the dissent, remember, because both in-staters and out-of-staters alike are banned from exporting minnows. There's no Dormant Commerce Clause violation because both in-staters and out-of-staters alike are banned from exporting minnows. Now, I think he's wrong as far as Dormant Commerce Clause goes. Why is he wrong in using that analysis to say there's no Dormant Commerce Clause violation? In-staters and out-of-staters alike are banned from exporting minnows. In other words, there's no discrimination under the Dormant Commerce Clause because both in-staters and out-of-staters cannot export minnows. What's wrong with that analysis? Yeah. Well, out-of-staters can use them inside the state, too. Out-of-staters can catch them and sell them inside the state. What they can't do is bring them outside the state. Neither one can bring them outside. Everybody can buy and sell them in. Nobody can get them inside and take them out. Yeah, it's not the buying and selling inside the state that matters for Dormant Commerce Clause purposes. It's whether you treat the out-of-staters differently. Here, the out-of-state interests are treated differently in that you can't export the minnows. So you can't have them, possess them, sell them, use them outside the state. So there is discrimination, not necessarily against an out-of-state citizen, but against an out-of-state commercial interest. That's where the discrimination is. So there is discrimination against out-of-state commerce. There may not be a discrimination against an out-of-state citizen, but there's a discrimination against an out-of-state commerce. Rehnquist's argument makes sense, not as a Dormant Commerce Clause argument. It's a privileges and immunities argument. His argument is basically, should have been, there's no privileges and immunities violation because out-of-state citizens and in-state citizens alike are banned from exporting minnows. And that's correct. No privileges and immunities violation. But there is a dormant commerce clause violation because out-of-state commerce is discriminated against vis-a-vis in-state commerce. Okay, so you can see the difference in how the two clauses operate. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, boy, it's great having just a handful of people, not too many questions. Okay, can barrel right on through here. Okay, again, let's illustrate the differences and similarities by looking at the three local hire cases in your book. Your book really talks about just the Camden case, Camden versus United Building and Construction Trades Council versus Camden on 276. But the other two cases are discussed within Camden. So I'm going to actually start with one of those discussed within Camden. That's the White case, White versus Massachusetts Council of Construction Employees, referred to on 276. And this is a 1983 case in which the city of Boston requires that a minimum of 50% of the workers on all city-funded construction projects have to be Boston residents. So it's a local hire regulation. 50% of the workers on city-funded projects have to be Boston residents. And the court says this is constitutional under the Dormant Commerce Clause. It does not violate the Dormant Commerce Clause. Now here's a very clear preference for insiders versus outsiders. Why is this not a Dormant Commerce Clause violation? A facial, overt discrimination against the out-of-staters or out-of-towners. Why isn't that a Dormant Commerce Clause violation? Yeah. Yes. The market participant exception, right? The state is a participant in the construction market here. It's buying construction services. And it's allowed to prefer its own when it's acting as a market participant. So the city here is just like a private construction company, employer, and therefore can do what it wants with regard to this hiring. Now, a little nuance, but the court's not concerned with it. The city is not actually the employer. It bids out this work. So the work is actually done by private companies. And the employees actually are employees of private companies. But the court says, look, that's not what really matters. What really matters is city money is used. This only applies to projects on which city money is used. It only applies to projects where the city is buying the service. So it has that limited effect on the market. Remember the market participant principle. The limited effect on the market that the state has when it's preferring its own, when it's a market participant, because it only controls that little piece of the market. Same here. It's using its money. It doesn't have unlimited funds to construct buildings and roads and whatever. So it's limited effect on the market. It's not regulating. It's a participant in the market. Okay, that's a clear case. Then that brings us to the Camden case itself. Now, this looks like almost the same regulation, doesn't it? The city of Camden, New Jersey, requires that 40% local residents be hired on city-funded construction projects. Same thing, right? It's 40% versus 50%, but otherwise it's basically the same rule. The court does not find a constitutional violation so quick. The court does not find the measure constitutional so quickly as it did in White, but rather it remands it on the ground that it could be unconstitutional. Why? Why does it remand the case? Why might it be unconstitutional? Mr. Denny? It might violate the Privileges and Immunities Clause, says the court. And how so? How might this violate the Privileges and Immunities Clause? What would be, start with the first step of the test, what would be the fundamental right at issue? employment, absolutely. Work, that's fundamental, especially today. We can all relate to that. Work, the ability to work, having a job, that's pretty fundamental in these respect, in the respects we're talking about now. So there's a fundamental right at stake. Is there differential treatment of in-staters and out-of-staters? Well, absolutely. Here it's out-of-towners, actually. But the courts often said that that's equivalent. So there's a disparate treatment of out-of-staters. Out-of-staters are not afforded the same access to this fundamental right. So the court sends the case back, having found part one of privileges and immunities, it sends it back for a determination about step two. Is there a substantial reason for this discrimination against the out-of-staters? It tells the lower court, apply the Toomer test and tell us whether there's a violation or not. Now, we have the same facts here and in the Camden case. Why is there a different result? Same discrimination, different result. Why? I'll give you a big hint. There's an easy answer. There's a quick and dirty and easy answer. Yes? That's right. This wasn't a dormant Commerce Clause argument. It was what argument? Privileges and immunities. Right. And in White, the claimants only made a dormant Commerce Clause argument. They failed to make the privileges and immunities argument. So the court only decided the dormant Commerce Clause argument. Here, the parties raised privileges and immunities. Okay. Now, but why not the same result anyway? Because it's still just city money on, you know, the city's limited market. So why not the same result? Ms. Mills?
Because the same exceptions don't apply for the two. The market participation exception doesn't work for the privileges.
Exactly. There is, the court here tells us in this case, there is no market participant exception to the privileges and immunities clause. Now, that's a big difference. So the state has this big sort of out when it comes to dormant commerce clause. It may prefer its own with regard to the dormant commerce clause, but it may not necessarily with regard to the privileges and immunities clause. There's no market participant exception to this clause, says the court. Now, that would seem to be a pretty neat rule, and that's exactly the kind of rule they'd love to put on a bar exam, because there's that little difference. They catch you, you don't know that the market participant exception doesn't apply to that clause. But to be true lawyers, which I don't know if this level of nuance makes it to the bar exam, but I'm going to introduce it to you because you're going to be out there practicing. It's not entirely clear to me that the market participant considerations wouldn't still be relevant to a court. And I think there's some indication there's actually a Second Circuit case I came across that I now suddenly can't find that seems to bear this out. But when the court was sending the case back on remand, it said, it is crucial, but not decisive, that the city is spending its own money. And you see this discussion on page 278. It's crucial, but not decisive, that the city is spending its own money on this project. On remand, determining, when the court is set to determine whether there's a substantial reason to discriminate against the out-of-state, out-of-towners with regard to this employment, it is crucial, but not decisive, that the city is spending its own money. Now, what does that mean? Okay, not decisive, we know what that means. There's no market participant exception. If there were a market participant exception, that would be decisive. The fact that it's the city's money would be decisive. So they're telling us it's not decisive, it's not an official exception. But it's crucial. Well, what does that mean? It's crucial. I think what it means is that on remand, the court is supposed to take into account, when determining whether there's a substantial reason to discriminate, the fact that the city is spending its own money. So the very same consideration that causes the market participant exception should still be taken into account by the court. It may not determine the outcome, but it's still important. It's still relevant that the city has to have some leeway to use its tax money for the benefit of its citizens in such a way, as long as it's got a limited impact on out-of-staters and on the market. It's not going to be determinative. Maybe you need some other factor, too, but it's at least crucial. So it's importantly relevant, it seems to me. So the market participant exception doesn't apply, but perhaps the considerations for the rationale for the exception enters right back into the substantial reason test, possibly. Now, the reason I say possibly is when this case was remanded, what happened? It was settled. So we don't actually know whether it would have mattered or not. It didn't go back to court. It was settled by the parties. Okay. Any questions so far? We have one last case to cover. Okay, and that brings us to the last local hire case, also discussed within the Camden case on page 278. That's the Hicklin versus Orbit case. This is the Alaska local hire statute. Alaska owns a lot of oil and gas reserves, as I mentioned in my class last night. As everybody now knows, after the last election, Alaska is the home of oil and gas. So oil and gas, the state owns these reserves, this natural resource. And what the state tried to do in this case was to say, if the state sells its oil and gas, anybody, any company, any person who is engaged in a business of any sort or any transaction of any sort, even remotely related to the buying and selling of the Alaskan oil or gas, has to hire locally. They have to give a hiring preference to locals, to Alaskans. So that means not just the people, not just when the state buys or sells its own oil and gas, it has to prefer its own, but whoever buys the oil and gas from Alaska, then when they do whatever they do with it, they have to give a local hiring preference too. So if I'm an out-of-state company and I buy so many gallons of Alaskan oil, I have to give Alaskans a local hiring preference when I process it and then when I sell it again. I have to give a local preference. So it takes that hook that it has of control over the natural resources and tries to use it to control all these different companies and operations, as the court says, far downstream from its own transaction it's engaged in. Now, the court says this is unconstitutional under the Privileges and Immunities Clause. And here we see unanimously, there's no disagreement. Why is it unconstitutional? How is this different from White and Camden, where there was the local hire preference? What's the difference between those local hire preferences and this local hire preference? Yes.
Is the Alaska hire a full effect throughout other parts of the country, whereas those are just limited to those cities?
Well, there could be ripple effects in other parts of the country for local hire, too, and that's who complained. People, not just from inside the state and outside the city, but from outside the state as well. If they live near Camden's, near the border, so Pennsylvanians might have. So there's some ripple effect. But I think the answer does have to do with the nature of the ripple effect. So what's the difference between the ripple effect in the local hire construction projects and the ripple effect under this statute? Or the possible ripple effect under this. Yes?
Closer to the commerce clause effects, where it's forcing out out-of-staters to do something to
initiate.
Like the cat folks case.
I guess, possibly. I had never thought of that, but that might be. That might be part. You might be forcing some out-of-state transaction. I had not. The extraterritorial effect is possible. I hadn't considered that because this case actually predated the extraterritorial cases, so there wasn't that discussion. But that's a very good answer. Yeah, Ms. Mills.
Could it be when you were talking about the limestone and the cement, that it had something to do with the natural resource?
Yes. It could have something to do with the natural resource, but I don't think that... Well, it does in the sense that the state is trying to take something that's limited, and use it to control. But it's allowed to control somewhat limited. It's just not allowed to do this. This isn't about who can buy the limited resource. This is about what people who buy it then have to do. So it's a little bit different. What's the ripple effect problem here, Mr. Bennett?
Is it because it goes beyond the contract and subconscious
and
we're dealing
directly with the resources? Yes. It goes beyond the transaction where the state is buying or selling its own oil and gas. It goes beyond that transaction. So it's affecting, as the court says, too much downstream, too many other later, different markets, different transactions. And that has too great an impact on many markets, inside, outside the state, and undermines national unity. That's why it's unconstitutional. It affects transactions where there's no state money expended, no state resources at issue, or being directly sold or not by the state. Okay, so it's in that way different from the other cases. And therefore, I think, Mr. Park? Yeah. You were correct. It does have to do with the ripple effect. The other cases do have a ripple effect outside somewhat, but not as big a ripple, not as many ripples, if you will. So that's a good, actually, allegory here. Okay, let's take a break. Come back at 10 after. Yeah, sure. Because of the way it's worded, it says the citizens of each state shall be entitled to the privileges and immunities. So it by its very language, focuses you on citizenship.
Right. I don't understand.
You're losing me now.
What's the latest? The citizens having the right to the same citizens?
Because they're not. You mean in the last case we talked about?
Yeah.
Oh, because they are treated differently. The citizens, in-state citizens, get a preference over out-of-state citizens.
But the reason it seems to, and we're talking about the ripple effect, doesn't seem to address.
Well, it affects how many will be treated differently, I guess, is the way I would put it. There's a far-reaching discrimination, if you will, against affected, right, as opposed to just a few local citizens, a few local out-of-staters, or what, I'm not saying that well, but a few who are connected just with the initial transaction, out-of-staters. I guess his point was very good about the, it's almost like an extraterritorial effect. It's going way down from the initial transaction. It isn't necessarily extraterritorial. Some of the regulation will be in the state, some will be out. Some of the preferences will be going on inside the state. Some of the preferences will be going on outside the state. But they will involve out-of-state interests, companies, whatever, way beyond the initial transaction. But that's a very good question, because if you're conceiving of it in terms of people as opposed to... Right. But in the modern iteration of privileges and immunities, it's not just about... a particular bundle of rights. It's about discrimination, and there is still discrimination. And the farther you go from the initial sale or transaction, the more you control, the more you're regulating, then the more discrimination there is. That's right.
Okay.
But there's still discrimination with regard to individuals in this case, because it's a higher statute. It's a hiring statute. Right. I was going to wear jeans today, and then I thought, oh no, they're going to record me. I have to look semi-professional, right? And I forgot they're not going to record.
I should have gone all out for the jeans.
Yeah. 30,000 cups in the faculty lounge, and not one of them is for hot drinks. Who did that? Mr. Park empty his cup if I can use it. I was saying there's all these cups, there's thousands of cups in there, and none of them are hot cups. So you can't get a cup of coffee in the faculty. They put this newfangled kind of coffee machine in there, so you put those little containers in, and it makes that, it's reasonably tolerable. It's as good as the Lachman coffee around the campus, but, you know. It's as good as the non-Starbucks coffee on campus, let's put it that way. Right. Right, exactly. Okay, guys, let's start again so we don't run out of time again. Okay, now, so far, we're going to start the next chapter now, chapter 5. So far, we've been talking about limitations on government power. And the next half of the course, starting now and going all the way through next semester, is also about limitations on government power, believe it or not. But there are different kinds of limitations on government power. Now, the kinds of limitations we've talked about so far are limitations that arise out of the structure of government. We talked about divisions of power among the different branches of the federal government, and those divisions of power limit what government can do. And we also talked about division of power between the states and the federal government. That's the last chapter that we talked about. And those kinds of divisions of power, also the structural provisions that create limitations on what the government can do, in this case, what state government can do. From now on, what we're going to talk about are limitations on government power that arise not so much out of the structure of government, but rather as a result of the existence of individual rights. So individuals possess particular rights under our Constitution. with which the government cannot interfere, and that ban on government interference with those rights limits government power. So again, it's another form of limitation of government power. So the entire Constitution, basically, is designed to limit government power, to set up a government, but at the same time, to limit government power. Okay, let's see how these work. We're going to start with just the whole idea that there are such things as substantive rights or protections that limit government power. Now, we know there are some because they're named in the Constitution. But the really interesting notion is, what about the ones that are not named in the Constitution? Are there substantive rights or protections not specifically mentioned in the Constitution against government interference with private action? And the idea that there are such rights dates back all the way to the very beginning of our republic. If you remember when I was talking about Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4 just a few minutes ago, we talked about natural law rights, that people, just by virtue of being citizens of free governments, had natural rights. These just would naturally exist. That was the first understanding, that there might be unenumerated rights that existed that could be enforced against the government for the benefit of individuals. And we see this all the way back in 1798 on page 293 in the case of Calder versus Bull. You see an argument between Justice Chase and Justice Iredell. Justice Chase says there is natural law. And natural law means that there are implied, inherent limits on the legislative power. There are things the legislature just simply can't do because it's infringing on the rights of the natural rights of us as people, as citizens. And then you see Justice Iredell arguing with that notion and saying, no, we have a constitution now, a written constitution. Our constitution does not permit the courts to strike legislation based on natural law. If it's not in the constitution, then it isn't a limit on the government. And as Iredell says, the problem with recognizing natural law rights is that it's not regulated by any fixed standard. What are those natural rights? How do we know what they are? How do we know how extensive they are? They're not written somewhere. They're natural. So the justices have to opine on what they might be. And that's problematic for him. So he says that contravenes the whole notion of having a written constitution. And then a few years later in Fletcher versus Peck, you see that notion of natural law rights appealing to Justice Marshall, who says he cites natural law principles as an alternative ground for overruling legislation in that particular case. It was an alternative ground, so it's a dicta, I guess. But again, the appeal of natural rights early on. But after a while, as the Constitution took hold, the idea that there were natural rights not in the Constitution begins to come into disfavor, bless you, because now we're starting to conceive of ourselves as a rule of law state, where we follow rules of positive law. And you can't have things like natural law in such a regime. They're too amorphous, unidentified, etc. So the only limits on legislation then become specified constitutional limits. And we sort of come to agree to adopt that view. So by the mid-19th century, if you wanted to recognize a right against government action, you had to identify a constitutional home for it. It had to live somewhere in a constitutional clause, or else it didn't exist. Even if it was a fundamental right, or a natural kind of right. So what we find in these cases in that period is the courts start to try to use different clauses as homes for these very appealing rights that aren't enumerated. And the one place that courts have settled on is the due process clauses. Historically, let me just say, when they focus on these clauses, they use them as a substantive limit on the legislative power. They are a substantive restraint. If something is a due process right, the legislature may not interfere with it, period, substantively, may not interfere with it. Now, historically, I say substantively to contrast this with, the due process language came from English law, where it meant procedure. It referred to procedural protections. Particular methods of trial were required to protect people against government overreaching. But it was a procedural kind of protection, not a substantive kind of protection. Eventually, again in the mid-19th century, the state courts began to use these constitutional limits, began to use the due process clause, rather, as a constitutional substantive limit on legislation, on the content of legislation. Legislation could not substantively have a particular content. Not just you had to be afforded certain procedure, but certain substance was forbidden altogether. And you see an example on page 295 in New York State in the Weinheimer case. Now, as I said, the courts went through different clauses. They didn't only look to the Due Process Clause, but all this occurred around the time of the Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments, and so this gave new hope for homes for substantive protections. There was the 13th Amendment, which forbid involuntary servitude, slavery. The 14th Amendment, which gave a whole host of rights to the former slaves, citizenship, federal citizenship, privileges and immunities, due process, equal protection. And the 15th Amendment, which afforded the right to vote regardless of race. So all of these amendments, by their express terms, limited state government power. State governments could not do these things. They could not interfere with voting rights based on race. They could not permit slavery, etc. The 14th Amendment had three clauses that were argued at one time or another to be the home of these substantive protections or rights. The Privileges and Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment, the Due Process Clause, and the Equal Protection Clause. They were all argued to provide this kind of substantive protection. But in the Slaughterhouse cases, which we're going to look at in just a moment, on 298, the court rejects every one of these three as the home for any really significant kinds of substantive protection. Now, let's start with the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment. We've just looked at the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4. So how do they compare? Listen to the language. Article 4. The citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. Citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. 14th Amendment. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. So the first difference is one refers to citizens of state. The Article 4 protects state citizens, and the 14th Amendment protects federal citizens. Okay. Now, historically, at the time that the 14th Amendment Privileges and Immunities Clause was adopted, if you go to the Article 4 Privileges and Immunities Clause interpretation, we were back in the fundamental natural rights era. The court was just moving from fundamental rights, from natural law rights are protected, to fundamental rights created by the states are protected. So it was whatever was fundamental about state citizenship that was protected. The right to earn a living, for example, as we talked about, was protected. So when the 14th Amendment was adopted, it was first naturally argued, well, the same rights are now protected that were protected by virtue of being a state citizen are now carried over and protected by virtue of being a federal citizen. It's the same privileges and immunities. It's just before they were protected by virtue of state citizenship, now they're protected by virtue of federal citizenship. Did the court interpret the clause that way? Well, the answer is no. The first opportunity it was faced with to do this was the Slaughterhouse cases. And it did not do that. So let's go to the slaughterhouse cases. We have a Louisiana legislature that grants a monopoly to a New Orleans slaughterhouse. Everybody is allowed to use the slaughterhouse who needs to use a slaughterhouse. And the fee is regulated by the state, so the slaughterhouse can't charge some outrageous fee. It's limited by the state. What was the point of this law, by the way? Why did New Orleans grant a monopoly? Ms. Latuga?
The state wanted to remove the obnoxious slaughterhouses from the population,
right,
so they can get away from them.
Right. There were unsanitary, noxious conditions in the slaughterhouse industry. I don't know if you've ever been to a slaughterhouse. It's pretty gross. So they didn't want them all over the city. This way they would put it all in one neighborhood. They could oversee it. They could regulate it. They could inspect it. So it was to alleviate an unsanitary, improper condition. Now, the plaintiffs in this case were butchers, slaughterhouse owners, who were not granted the monopoly. Of course, they complained. They didn't get the monopoly. And their claim was, look, we have a right to earn a living. You've just taken away our right to earn a living. And that right, they said, is guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. By the 14th Amendment. They actually named three different clauses in the 14th Amendment. So first they say the due process clause. It's guaranteed by due process. And the court's response is, well, the due process clause, which we'll get to in a minute, says you can't be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And here the court says, well, you weren't deprived of life, liberty, or property. Your right to earn a living is not your life, it's not your liberty, it's not your property. That will change later, but here that's what the court says. Equal protection, they say. Our right to equal protection is violated because the monopoly slaughterhouse is treated differently than we are. And the court says equal protection doesn't apply because it only applies, remember these clauses were all new at that time, it only applies to discrimination against Negroes, against former slaves. And that's not you. That was the purpose of the clause. And again, that interpretation will later change, but this was the first understanding of that clause. So finally, they settle on the Privileges and Immunities Clause and say, okay, well, our right to earn a living is violated, and that's protected by the Privileges and Immunities Clause. Why? Because the right to earn a living was exactly the kind of thing protected by the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4. Okay, well, if that's so, why didn't these plaintiffs just argue our privileged immunities right under Article 4 is violated? We already knew that included the right to earn a living. Why didn't they argue Article 4? Yes. Can't hear you. They're not out-of-state citizens. Exactly. They were in-state citizens. Exactly. So they couldn't remember the parties who can raise it. Only an out-of-stater can raise the privileges and immunities. So they couldn't have that claim. So they said, well, we'll raise the identical claim under this comparable provision of the new amendment. And the court said, well, no. You don't get that one either. And why not? Is the right to earn a living a fundamental right of federal citizenship protected by the 14th Amendment Privileges and Immunities Clause? The answer is no. Why not? What does the court say is covered by this clause and what's not? Note what the court says is not covered. It says, it's not the purpose of the 14th Amendment Privileges and Immunities Clause to simply transfer protection of the same civil rights from state citizens to federal citizens, so that now even in-staters could raise them. It's not the purpose of the clause to take the same bundle of rights and transfer them from these citizens to those citizens. That's not what it was there for. So what is it there for? What kind of rights does it protect? Oh, you know what? I just realized that in this latest edition of the book, this is excerpted out. So that's why everybody's looking so quietly at me, because this is excerpted out. But it's very important, so I'm going to excerpt it back in. I'm going to insert it back in. The court says that the 14th Amendment only protects those privileges and immunities that, and here's the quotation, owe their existence, unquote, the ones that owe their existence to the federal government, its national character, and its constitution and laws. So this clause is only going to protect those rights that owe their existence to the federal government, character, constitution, and law. For example, gives examples, the right to petition the government and the right of assembly that we see in the First Amendment. You get those by virtue of the federal constitution. The right of habeas corpus. You get that by virtue of it being in the constitution. Treaty rights, which you get by virtue of the constitution and the treaty. The right to use waterways interstate, again implied from the constitution. Those are the type of rights, federal rights, rights that have this federal character. And that's what's covered by your federal citizenship, not just the same old rights covered by state citizenship. Now, Justice Field in his dissent says, look, that's a pretty useless way to interpret this clause. Because if these rights are already pre-existing in the Constitution, or necessarily implied from the Constitution, like the right of assembly or petition or habeas corpus, then they're already protected by the federal government. So what are you adding with the Privileges and Immunities Clause? You're not getting anything more. It would be surplusage. It would be useless. So therefore, it must include those other natural rights that are fundamental, like the right to earn a living. Well, Justice Field was not exactly right, because he's right today, but he wasn't right when he said that. He was not correct when he said that. Because when he said that, the rights that were in the Constitution, like the right to peaceably assemble, the right to petition in the First Amendment, were protected only against federal government interference. The Bill of Rights at that point in time was understood, for reasons we'll get to next semester, only to protect against federal government intrusions. And it didn't protect, those provisions did not protect against states interfering with those rights. So the idea was, well, now the Civil War amendments came along as limits on what the state governments could do. Because this was after the Civil War. The states had acted very badly, especially toward former slaves. So the idea was that these amendments were going to force the states to treat people right. And the argument was then that the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment was going to give these same protections that at that time were only protected against federal interference to citizens, so they could be protected against state interference as well. So not only couldn't the federal government ban you from petitioning your government, but the state of Alabama couldn't either. That was the point. And so Field was wrong, because at that time this would have been useful in that way. As it turns out today, by virtue of the doctrine of incorporation, which you will study next semester, which I'm not going to go into now, these rights are incorporated, all those rights in the Bill of Rights, all but two, almost every right in the Bill of Rights, is incorporated and applied against the state government as well. So states cannot interfere with those rights also today, just as well as the federal government can. The state can't abridge your right to free speech, just like the federal government can't abridge your right to free speech. But that was a relatively modern development. All that occurred in the latter half of the 20th century. So at the time he spoke, that was not really the law. Okay, but that was how the court interpreted the Privileges and Immunities Clause. Basically, very narrowly, it only protected these federal nature rights against state interference. So in this case, the court basically leaves the 14th Amendment Privileges and Immunities Clause with not doing very much. And after incorporation, it does basically nothing. It becomes virtually useless because these rights are guaranteed anyway against the states. And, okay. Now, that was until recently. In 1999, after 100 years of or more of this clause meaning virtually nothing, it suddenly is resurrected in a Supreme Court case, in a case called Sayens versus Roe, which you see on page 303 in your book. And in this case, the court holds that the 14th Amendment Privileges and Immunities Clause does protect one particular aspect of the right to travel. It says there are three aspects to the right to travel, and one of them is protected by the Privileges and Immunities Clause. So all of a sudden, maybe this clause actually does something. Maybe it protects something. But, you know, one little tiny inroad, and we have yet to see another. So just keep it in the back of your mind should you need it someday. Maybe you can make an analogy to Sayens. Okay. Now, note that in this case, the court was very wary of something that Justice Iredell said way in the beginning. It was very wary of the notion of unenumerated rights because the court was worried that it took subjective judgment on the part of the justices to figure out what these specific rights of federal citizenship would be that were protected against the state. And the court avoided the whole morass of unenumerated rights. It didn't want to go there. If the right isn't spelled out somewhere, or implied from a right that's spelled out somewhere, then it doesn't exist. And the court was uncomfortable with finding it. But the idea that there are these rights that seem awfully fundamental to most of us, and that they must, therefore, be protected somewhere in our Constitution, is a very appealing idea. And it basically never dies. It moves around, it changes, it takes a little bit different form. It's housed in different constitutional clauses over history, but it never dies. And a whole lot of what you're going to study next semester is about unenumerated rights. Some you'll study is enumerated rights, and some of what you'll study is unenumerated rights. Because the idea is so appealing that there are these rights. We must have them. Our Constitution is so good, it must contain them. And so it never quite goes away. So it rears its head again after slaughterhouse cases, and it comes back now in a different clause, in a different form. It comes back in the due process clause. And it comes back with regard to economic rights, the right to earn a living, the right to enter into a contract for your employment. In Lochner, on 305, New York has a statute that limits the hours of bakery workers. And the court says that statute is unconstitutional. Why? Not because it violates privileges and immunities. That's dead already. But rather, this is 1905, by then privileges and immunities means nothing. Because it violates the 14th Amendment due process clause. Now, what's the right at stake? The right to enter into a contract for your labor, the right to contract. The due process clause says you shall not be deprived, no state shall deprive any citizen of their life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Which one was deprived of here? If your right to contract is interfered with, is that your life, your liberty, or your property? Your liberty. That's what the court says. Your liberty, protected by the due process clause, encompasses the right to contract. So the issue, the right at stake is the right to contract for your labor. Liberty protects your right to contract. And lastly, the due process clause substantively protects your liberty interests against government interference, against the state interfering with them. It protects them substantively. Now, we'll get in a moment to what that means, but let's look at liberty is protected. Is all your liberty protected? If your liberty to contract is protected, presumably that's because your liberty to contract means your freedom to contract. Liberty would mean freedom, your freedom to contract. Is your freedom to do whatever you want protected by this clause? Would the court protect your liberty, your freedom, to ride in a car without a seatbelt? I see you shaking your head. No, no, of course not. It doesn't. The state's permitted to pass a law interfering with your liberty to ride in the car without a seatbelt. But if not permitted to enact a law interfering with your right to negotiate for your hours of work. So why can it interfere with one particular freedom and not another? Ms. Benson? Okay, so we're so stupid we can't figure out that we need a seatbelt, but we're smart enough to figure out how, you know, to be able to negotiate for our labor hours, I guess.
I don't know, they made it sound to me like this is an area where they can and should be able to protect themselves.
Right. What are you, demeaning workers? They can't go out and negotiate their own contracts for themselves? You've got to say what the maximum hours and working conditions can be? Let those workers be free. Let them be free to negotiate with their employers, those bakery workers. Why was this statute enacted? Why did New York enact a statute limiting the hours and requiring certain wages for bakery workers? That's what they say. Why did they really enact the statute, do you suppose? Were they really worried about the health of the health of whom, by the way? The workers or the people who ate the bread they made?
It seemed like the bakers.
Well, they actually say both. They say the health of the workers and the health of the public. Like somehow if they work too long, the bread's going to be bad. You know, they're going to make bad bread. I don't know what's going to happen. Germs will seep in. You know, the longer they stay there. So, to protect their health, you know, they can protect their health. Why do you think the statute was enacted? Why didn't you just let them bargain for their health benefits or whatever, for shorter hours? They needed shorter hours. Why not just let them bargain? Like the court is ultimately saying to them, the statute's unconstitutional. Go out and bargain for your health. You can do it. Why was the statute enacted? If they could bargain. Yeah, theoretically they could bargain, but they had no bargaining power. That's why it was enacted. It was enacted to protect them, and it was enacted to protect them against onerous conditions of work because they couldn't protect themselves. They didn't seem to have the political, financial, whatever power to protect themselves. You don't like this job? Go find another one. We've got somebody else waiting in the wings to take that job at a lot of hours at a low wage. They got the state to help them, and then the court basically took it away and said, you can bargain for yourselves. You know, it's insulting to the workers to tell them that they can't bargain for themselves. Well, the workers were happy with the statute, but okay. So the idea that, you're right, Ms. Benson, that somehow the court is saying, well, they couldn't protect, could protect themselves here, but somehow we are helpless to protect ourselves with regard to seatbelts. I don't know. It just doesn't quite sit with me. What the court says is the right to contract in this way is fundamental. It's fundamental. You have to be free to do that. That's a fundamental kind of right. The right, perhaps, to drive around without a seatbelt is not fundamental. How do we know what's fundamental? How do we know what rights are fundamental? Notice what happens is the idea that there are fundamental rights not named in the Constitution that we nevertheless have comes back here. So we saw it in the Slaughterhouse cases. You see it again here. Fundamental rights basically never die. They just keep coming back. People love fundamental rights. Now, here it's economic rights. Later we'll see next semester personal rights become the repository of unenumerated rights. But at the turn of the century, people weren't worried about esoteric things like, you know, abortion rights. They were worried about more fundamental things like, could I put bread on the table? That was fundamental right in those days. So economic rights were fundamental at this point in time. Later, when economic conditions are more favorable, other rights become more fundamental. Moral, social, other kinds of rights become more fundamental. But notice here, the court is protecting this right substantively, not procedurally. So the due process clause is being used not to give you procedure, to give you substance. Now let's examine that notion for a moment. Here are the texts of the two due process clauses. The Fifth Amendment: no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And this applies to the federal government. No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And then the 14th Amendment due process clause says, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So they're very similar, virtually identical. One applies against the federal government, one applies against the states. Can't be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Now, let's erase these clauses from our Constitution for a moment. If we never had these clauses, could the government deprive you of your life, liberty, or property? Let's take property just as an example. Could there be a circumstance in which the government, the legislature, could decide to deprive you of your property? Could the legislature say, for example, any property used in a crime will be confiscated by the state? We're going to deprive you of it. If these clauses did not exist, could the government do that? Yes, of course. Why not? The legislature could. There's nothing to prevent that. You use your property in a crime, we're taking it away. Now let's, in that instance, where we don't have this, who would determine whether the government could deprive you of your property? Who would be the party to determine whether that was permissible? Can the government deprive you of your property? The answer is yes. Who determines that? Who says we're going to take your property if it's used in a crime?
The legislature.
That's a legislative policy determination. When, under what circumstances, will the government take your property? Or your life or your liberty, whichever. That's if we didn't have these clauses. Now, let's add the clauses back in. Does that change anything? Do they say the government, now that we have them, cannot confiscate your property if it's used in a crime? Do they say that, Ms. Svensson? Right. So they can still take your property. They can still engage in the substantive deprivation. The government still can do that. It just has to give you due process of law before it takes the property. So now the trick is we've got to figure out what due process of law is. Well, remember, this was borrowed from English law, where due process of law meant procedural process. Before the government could take your car because it was supposedly used in a crime, it had to give you process. It had to give you maybe things like notice that we're thinking of taking away your car because we believe it was used in a crime. It had to give you perhaps a hearing where you got to come forward and say, no, I didn't use my car in a crime. Don't take it away from me. Maybe it would have to give you a neutral decision maker to say, gee, do I think that property was used for a crime or not? Maybe it would have to give you the right to present witnesses, the right to cross-examine adverse witnesses, all these kinds of processes and procedures that we're very familiar with. Maybe the right to an attorney. I'll get to questions in a second. At the end of the day, though, after you got all your process, whatever process was due process of law, once you got your due process, the government could take your property away. It still could confiscate it. It could deprive you of it. And what was the point of the process then? The point of the process was to try to prevent mistakes in taking away your property. If the legislature sets a policy that we will only take your property when it was used for a crime, the point of the process is to try to ensure that the property is only taken when it truly was used for a crime. But substantively, the government could still take your property And sometimes there would be mistakes, even with all the process in the world. There will be mistakes. And sometimes people's property would be taken, even when it was not actually used for a crime. So the standard would be there. Sometimes there would be mistakes, even with due process of law. So the process didn't guarantee an unfair deprivation. It just tried to ensure that it wouldn't happen often. That's what due process meant, procedurally. But now, what Lochner is saying is, you don't just get procedural due process, you get substantive due process. What does that mean? That means the government cannot deprive you of your life, liberty, or property at all. Period. Sometimes. The legislature cannot decide that it's okay to deprive you sometimes of your property. And what's the sometimes? How do we know when it can't and when it can? Well, in Lochner, the court tells us reasonableness is the standard. When it's unreasonable for the government to take your property, it cannot. And who decides when it's unreasonable? Exactly. You would think it should be the legislature, but in this case, it's the judges. That's what it is. Because the judges say they are enforcing a constitutional prohibition against unreasonable deprivations of life, liberty, or property. So they think they are enforcing the due process clause. Not in a process way, however. They are enforcing it in a substantive way. And hence, the idea of substantive due process. And this is the first case that says substantive due process exists. Okay, now I'll take questions. Who had a question? Mr. Park?
I just had a question. I don't know if you know this. Does New York have some kind of law involving DUI risks? You get your car automatically taken away? So
yeah, that's right. And there's an elaborate law on what kind of procedure you can get and when you get it. You know, pre-deprivation and post-deprivation. And, you know, there's a whole elaborate law of procedural due process. Next semester we'll talk a little bit about procedural due process. Not actually a lot. A little bit.
I was thinking about the same thing when you just said, because even if it's determined later, my understanding of that law, even if it's determined later that you weren't legally drunk or whatever, your car's gone. I mean,
it may be gone, but they may have to compensate you. I don't know. I actually don't know that particular circumstance. Because there's elaborate law about procedural due process of all sorts. And we don't go into it in that much detail. But you should all know, and you'll study this next semester, when you're dealing with a procedural due process situation, they're very situation specific. You know, what process do you get if you're on probation or parole and you're alleged to have violated it? What process do you get if your car is taken for whatever reason? So, you know, if your welfare check is taken, is stopped, you know. So there are many, many kinds of procedural due process, and each one has its own body of law, and we just don't go into that. But you should be aware that they exist, and if you ever have to deal with a procedural due process situation, you've got to research what are the specific parameters of decisions in that area. Did somebody else have a question? Mr. Denning? No. I'm not inviting it. I'm just... I thought you had your hand up. Okay. And I'll stay after two if anybody has questions. Okay, so that's substantive due process. Now, why is the right to contract, in this case, viewed as a fundamental right? And, you know, I contrasted it with the right to wear a seatbelt, any other right. The right to, I love to use, the right to bury dead animals in your backyard. You know, that's not fundamental. The state can forbid that, but it can't forbid this right to contract. And basically, you can answer it. That was a rhetorical question, but go ahead, answer it. Yes, because the judges think so. I don't want to say arbitrarily, because I think they are intending to be true to their own notion of what's fundamental. It's arbitrary in the sense that it's their personal notion. That's where the arbitrary comes in. But, you know, it's their notion of what's fundamental. Now, next semester we'll talk endlessly about what's a fundamental right, and, you know, can it be grounded in something? Some judges try to ground it in history, tradition, you know, all kinds of things. What shocks the conscience? All these things are different standards used for what's fundamental. But ultimately it comes down to, did the court think the right was fundamental or not? It's very impressionistic, which is upsetting. I mean, it may be that I love exactly the same rights they find, but there's something uncomfortable about the amorphous nature of how they find them. Okay, so substantive due process. Now, let's look at the methodology of substantive due process, because it's still used today. You actually see it in the Lochner dissent more than in the majority opinion. But the court uses what we call the rational basis test
to determine whether there's a violation of substantive due process.
The rational basis test is a two-part test. First,
the court looks to the purpose of the measure. A state must have a rational purpose
for depriving somebody of life, liberty, or property as they purportedly have. This has to be rational. Other words are used in the case law. Legitimate means the same thing. Reasonable purpose or end. Sometimes they call it a purpose, sometimes they call it an end. Means the same thing. So, rational purpose.
Second, and if there's no rational purpose, you violated substantive due process right there. Don't even have to go to step two.
State has to have a rational reason for interfering with your right. And secondly, the means part of the test.
The means chosen by the state
to effectuate its interest, its purpose, have to be rationally related to achieving that purpose. Rational means. Hence the rational basis test. The means adopted to further the state's legitimate purpose have to be rationally related to achieving that purpose. They have to be a rational way of getting there, getting what the state wants. This is sometimes called the rational means. It's sometimes called the means end fit. There has to be a good means end fit. The means have to fit the end. If not, substantive due process violation. Either one. Now, applied in Lochner, the court finds a violation of the first prong. What was the purpose of the New York statute? You said earlier, what's your name? I'm sorry, Mr. Seifert. The court says earlier that the purpose was to protect the health of the bakers and of society. They say, and of society. Is that a rational purpose? Well, of course, protecting health is a rational purpose. So why did this law fail? It failed this prong as well as the second prong. Why does it fail the first prong? That's right. The court says, well, okay, you said the New York State, the real reason is health. We don't believe you. We're second-guessing the stated purpose. We believe the real purpose was to adjust the bargaining power of these parties to this contract, to give the workers better power than they had on their own. And the court says that's an illegitimate purpose. Not only does it second-guess the stated purpose, does it not defer to the state, but it also determines that what it thinks is the real purpose is illegitimate. It opines on the legitimacy of the purpose. Adjusting the bargaining powers is not a legitimate purpose for the state. It's not allowed to do that. I don't know why. It could be legitimate. One could say it's legitimate. That's what they're really doing. But it's legitimate to do that. Here the court says no, because you're impinging on a fundamental right to contract. It can't be legitimate. Is it always illegitimate to adjust the bargaining powers of the parties? Ms. Svensson pointed to a case before. You're right, Mueller versus Oregon, only 3 years after Lochner, you see on page 311. It's okay to have the same law to protect women and children. You couldn't have it for bakery workers, but you can have it for women and children. Then it's constitutional. Why? They're helpless. They can't protect themselves. Men, they can bargain. But women and children, they can't. They're powerless. Okay. Now, what about the second prong of the test? The court finds it fails the second prong as well. Why? the health, if health was the purpose, what's wrong with limiting the hours and raising the wages in order to protect health? The court says there's a bad fit. Regulating the hours of bakery workers is not reasonably related to promoting their health. I'm not sure why. I suppose you would be healthier if you didn't work as hard. But maybe not. Maybe you'll be healthier if you're moving your muscles. I don't know. But the court says there's not a good fit. So the court, how does it do that? It basically balances the benefit of the statute to the state, which it sees is not much, against the burdens of the individual. And it basically, and then comes out with a reasonableness standard. No reasonable legislature would put such a burden on such a fundamental right in order to obtain such a minimal benefit in health. So it's assessing the weight of everything, everywhere, and deciding, basically, it's not a good law. That's basically what the court's saying. Now, notice three characteristics of the substantive due process methodology as it's applied in the Lochner case. The court engages in refined balancing, is what I'll call it. It says, here's the state's interest, here's the burden on a fundamental right. Any tipping is enough to invalidate the law. No, I said that wrong. Yeah, right. The state's interest needs to be only just any tiny bit weightier than the burden for the state to win. And later on we'll see a different kind of test, strict scrutiny, where the state's interest has to be compelling to win. Here the state's interest just has to be good, okay, a little bit more than the burden. Second aspect of Lochner's methodology applied here, substantive due process applied here. Purpose analysis. I mentioned this already. The court is not deferential to the state legislature's determination that there was a legitimate purpose here. It second guesses what is the real purpose of the legislation, and it feels free to disagree with the legislature about what's a permissible or legitimate purpose as well. So no deference to the state legislature with regard to the purpose. A real scrutiny of that. And the third aspect is legislative fact analysis. The court is willing to redo the factual findings, to second guess the legislature's factual basis for its conclusions. It does not defer to the legislature on the issue of whether there's really a health benefit here or not. It second guesses that. It re-examines those facts, as a legislature normally would. Okay, now that's Lochner, and we're pretty much out of time, so I'm going to save the what happens next for the next class. So next Tuesday, we will finish this chapter. As I said, we will do 313 through 360. Should be the reading for next Tuesday. And hopefully we'll get through it. If not, we might have a little bit of overlap to the next class. Okay, so Tuesday the 11th, 313 to 360. Any questions before we break? Okay, great. So have a good weekend, everyone. I'll see you next week. Thanks for coming, you diehards.